The second jewel, the Dharma, the teaching of the Buddha.
Well communicated is the teaching of the richly endowed one, immediately apparent, perennial, of the nature of a personal invitation, progressive, to be understood by the wise. All my life, I go for refuge to the Dharma.
To say that Buddhism, or the Dharma, as it is called by Buddhists themselves, actually originated with the Buddha, in some sense, misrepresents it. The Buddha did not invent what he taught, any more than Newton invented gravity. He discovered it. What Siddhartha Gautama discovered when he became the Buddha is more difficult to say. It is sometimes called a form of psychotherapy because it offers a cure to the frustration and unhappiness of life. It is sometimes allied with the science of psychology because it offers a thoroughgoing analysis of the workings of the mind and because its theories are to be confirmed by direct personal experience. It is called a philosophy because it focuses on the central mystery of human existence and on how best to live in an ethically skillful way, and because it pursues these aims undistracted by premature conceptual resolutions, divine revelation, or doctrinal imperatives. It is, of course, called a religion because it arouses faith and devotion and employs myth and ritual, and because its goal is beyond the limitations of mundane existence. Finally, it is called a culture because of its contribution to Oriental art, literature, history, and to the whole way of life of large populations of the East, and now increasingly of the West. But if Buddhism is any or all of these things, it can only be up to a point. Buddhism is at once very lucid and very mysterious, very ancient and very modern. There are all sorts of aspects to it that link it with other forms of religion or other philosophical, psychological, even scientific ideas, but in its essence, it presents something that is quite different from anything else. The only real parallel to the Buddhist project from the traditions of the West is to be found in the teachings of ancient Greece. Though Greek philosophy eventually developed in a different direction from Indian philosophical inquiry of the same period, the two traditions shared a concern with exploring fundamental human values based on an appeal not to the authority of God or revelation or holy books, but to reason and experience. Give me, the Buddha said, any reasonable man who is sincere, honest, and straightforward, and I will teach him Dharma. Buddhism, like Greek philosophy, arises out of a resolve to focus on essentials. It arises out of an understanding that life comes before religion, that life comes before even the Dharma, that one is a human being first, and a Buddhist second. Ancient India, like ancient Greece, was an intellectual melting pot at that time, as the values of the traditional religious culture of animal sacrifice and conformity to one's allotted place in society were questioned and discarded in various different and usually extreme forms of thought and practice. Basically, men were prepared to try anything and believe anything in their search for truth. Some were convinced that the way to transcend the limitations of human existence was to behave as far as they could like a dog or a cow. Some lay on beds of spikes, and some never lay down at all. Some thought that all action was more or less impure, and that the very best thing one could do was to sit still and starve to death. Some were materialists, some were fatalists, some refused to believe in anything. And just as Socrates transcended the philosophical experimentation of his own culture, so the Buddha managed to forge a clear spiritual path through the free-for-all of his own world. Like Socrates, the Buddha was not concerned with a god and his supposed creation of the world, so much as with the meaning and purpose of human life, and how best to live it. A further parallel with Greek thought is in the Buddhist insistence that the practice of ethics, to be effective, must go hand in hand with the development of wisdom. The Buddha's rough contemporary, Heraclitus, taught that everything was in a state of flux, flowing, changing, becoming. Western scientists and philosophers have always tried to wriggle free of this comfortless and unpopular conclusion, but it has in the end proved difficult to deny. The Buddha was able to show how this truth is threatening only because it is rejected, and that when it is accepted deeply enough, an extraordinary transformation can take place. This is where the Dharma must be said to differ radically from what is generally known today as ancient Greek philosophy. The Buddha insisted that intellectual conclusions on their own are of no use at all. Reality must be ultimately realized not intellectually, but in every fiber of a person's being, and in everything they do, such as to effect a turning about, as it is said, in the deepest seat of consciousness. Thus have I heard. The Buddha's discourses are introduced with the phrase, "Thus have I heard." None of them were written down until about the 1st century BC. Up to this time, they were preserved orally, repeated and remembered for generation after generation. However, they still retain an inexplicable power to release the heart into boundless life.
Thus have I heard. At one time, the Exalted One was faring from place to place in the region of Kosala with a large company of monks. And he arrived at a town called Kesaputta, belonging to the Kalamans, who approached him. They said, "Lord, monks and Brahmins come and extol their views while abusing the views of others. We are doubtful about which views to take as truth and which as false."
"You are right to doubt, Kalamans. Look, do not trust blindly in what others tell you, or in what is handed down as traditional teachings, or in philosophical speculation, or in what is inferred through the exercise of logic, or in well-weighed evidence, or in a view that seems attractive, or out of a dubious respect for someone who teaches you. But when you yourselves know that these ideas are unprofitable, condemned by those you know to be wise, and lead to harm and suffering if put into actual practice, then dismiss those ideas."
On his enlightenment, the Buddha recognized with a totally uncompromising clarity how reality is veiled, and how this process might be reversed. Thus his awakening represents both a way of emancipation and a realization of the essential principle or law by which emancipation is attained. A direct experience. Yet the Buddha's awakening was not an intellectual illumination, but a direct experience of the way things are, of the dynamics of existence. And, like any experience, it may be referred to, but it may not be described such as to convey its real nature to anyone who has not had the experience themselves. How, for example, does one convey the depth and purity of a clear blue sky, or the intoxicating riot of a sunset, to someone who has never experienced them? The Buddha knew this from the first, that there was nothing that could be said about his awakening, that there was no fording point between nirvana and the way of being he had left behind, which he called samsara. Looking back to the unbridgeable torrent that he had crossed, the resolve of his compassion faltered at the prospect of communicating his vision. And then he saw that there was something, albeit limited, that he could do. He could design a raft that individuals would be able to build for themselves to carry them over to the other side. So how did the Buddha envisage this raft being built? How did he go about communicating his discovery to others?
"Best of ways is the Eightfold Way. Best of truths are the Four Truths. Clarity of heart is the best of states. The man of vision is the best of men."
The first of the five ascetics to awaken to the first teaching of the Buddha was called Ashvajit. One day he went into the city of Rajagriha for alms, and he met there another mendicant called Shariputra, who was immediately struck by Ashvajit's bearing Indeed, most people were impressed by the Buddha's monks, of whom it was said that they did not repent of the past, nor brood over the future, but lived in the present, from which practice of mindfulness they derived their radiance and evident joy in life. Shariputra asked Ashvajit whose teaching he professed. Ashvajit replied that he had gone forth under the dispensation of the great monk of the Shakyans, meaning the Buddha. Shariputra had not heard of him. What is his teaching, then? What is his philosophical position? Ashvajit modestly disclaimed any deep knowledge of what he had learned, but his brief reply was enough to immediately awaken Shariputra to an unshakable faith in the Buddha's teaching. Such is the mysterious power of this statement that it has been preserved not only in scriptures, but in stone inscriptions, clay tablets, and plates of silver and gold all over the Eastern world, from Afghanistan to Japan. What Ashvajit said was this:
"The Tathagata has explained the origin of those things which proceed from a cause. Their cessation, too, he has explained. This is the doctrine of the great Shramana."
Praticca Samutpada, dependent origination, the core teaching of the Buddha. Ashvajit was indicating to Shariputra the nature of the Buddha's most succinct and abstract formulation of his insight into the nature of things, a formulation usually known as dependent origination. It is an unlikely clarion call to the religious life, but this is in fact what it is, for once someone fully apprehends it, they are changed utterly. The formulation, in its entirety, runs as follows:
"This being, that becomes. From the arising of this, that arises. This not becoming, that does not become. From the ceasing of this, that ceases."
It sounds like a cool, objective, even unremarkable statement of universal causality. But it is not quite what it seems. The Buddha's long-time attendant, Ananda, once surmised that although this law of dependent origination was very profound, nevertheless it was quite easy to understand at a certain level. The Buddha firmly refuted this assumption.
"Say not so, Ananda, say not so. Deep indeed is this law of dependent origination, and deep it appears to be. It is by not understanding, by not penetrating this doctrine, that this world of men has become entangled like a ball of twine, become as though covered with mildew, become like munja grass and rushes, and unable to pass beyond the doom of the waste, the way of woe, the fall and the ceaseless round."
What then is so difficult about this bald account of the coming into being and passing away of things? Whence comes its power to free us from suffering? Perhaps the first thing to say about it is that it does not purport to describe the objective world as we usually see it. That is, it does not describe the world as a reality from which our perception of it has been excluded. It is well known that people from different cultures, in a sense, inhabit quite different worlds. But even with people we attempt to share our lives with, we tend to find ourselves momentarily misreading a situation or taking something the wrong way. So this is very much the Buddhist starting point. Yes, we see a world out there, a world of form, but the reality of what we experience is determined by our attitudes, our views, our feelings or emotions. As regards ourselves, as regards others, and as regards fundamental assumptions about the nature of what we experience. When, for example, artists paint what they see, they don't add their personal touch afterwards. It is actually there in the way they see, as it is in everyone's way of seeing. An artist offers us a representation of the way they create their own world, but in fact we all create the world we live in, moment by moment, a realm that may be human, animalistic, heavenly, or hellish. This is where Buddhism starts from, with the idea that we can, if we want to, change the way we create our world. So the concept of dependent origination is not a cool scientific one. Its objectivity is directed not towards external phenomena so much as towards one's own subjective responses to them. It is concerned with the creation of real objectivity of a particular way of seeing that is true. A true way of seeing that cannot be achieved without the development of compassion, a clear vision. To take the more obvious manifestations of this clear vision first, a river is not a fixed, unchanging object, though we find it useful to refer to it as such. A long rope is made up of lots of short fibres and has no continuous substance to it from one end to the other, but we are still able to trust it with our weight. A rainbow arises in dependence on certain precise meteorological conditions and disappears when those conditions disappear, but it still has a power to lift the heart. Sometimes we are even able to see traffic in this way, as a flow, a stream of constantly changing conditions. We know that a tailback is the result of various conditions. A spilled shipment of Spanish fertilizer or German hairdryers combined with the end of afternoon school. We may also be able to take responsibility for our own part in it. We also know that when the road has been cleared of fertilizer and the children are all back at home having their tea, the traffic will be moving freely again. We don't think of the tailback as a fixed thing, even though that is what it appears to be. Traffic is real. We know how to deal with it. But we know that it has no fixed reality. It is an impermanent set of conditions. Clear vision sees everything, and most importantly, oneself and others, in this sort of way. The trouble with being locked in a traffic tailback is that our minds are also in that tailback. The frustration and anger and selfishness we experience is just the mind getting gridlocked, and is the result of seeing ourselves and others as fixed entities rather than as changing patterns of conditions. If we can see ourselves and other drivers as being subject to the law of dependent origination, just as the traffic is, then we will come through that snarl up without getting snarled up ourselves. Seeing through the false idea of the self in this way does not mean losing one's identity. It means realizing one's true identity. Conditionality, a process without beginning or end. Finally, it should be said that this law of dependent origination is not exactly one of causality, that A leads to B and B leads to C, but of conditionality, a process without beginning or end or limits in any direction. Causation suggests that one separate thing produces another separate thing. With conditionality, one never ends up with a fixed thing, nor is there any first cause, like a god who created the world. Instead of a chain of events or a chain of command, one has a network of events, of relationships, all dependent on each other. For example, a commander of a regiment who forgets that his authority comes from his troops rather more than from his own chief is already in trouble. I may say that I experience homelessness as a direct result of John having burned down my house. That is causation. But according to the principle of conditionality, I experience homelessness in dependence upon an infinity of conditions. My house being combustible, John being given too much to drink, and then throwing away a lighted match, having taken up smoking to calm his nerves after his wife left him, and so on. But even then, these conditions do not actually determine that I become homeless. Because I experience homelessness in dependence also upon my attachment to my home, which was always impermanent anyway. If I am reduced to living in a shed, then someone who lived in a cardboard box would say that I was not homeless at all. Because there is an infinity of conditions, cause and effect cannot be isolated. What arises cannot actually be separated from the conditions that give rise to it. Nor even can this process be separated from the observer of it. so this principle finds a middle way between strict determinism on the one hand and the idea that there is no actual continuity at all between events on the other. According to the idea of causation, it should be possible to predict events, given enough data. According to conditionality, there is only the possibility of approximate predictions because reality is a seamless continuum, not a collection of data, however detailed we may try to make them. None of this sort of reasoning would have gone through the mind of Shariputra, however. All Ashvajit had to say was, the Tathagata has explained the origin of those things which proceed from a cause. Their cessation, too, he has explained. Shariputra understood as directly as if Ashvajit had showed him the way by pointing with his finger. In fact, the principle of dependent origination cannot be understood at all in the conceptual terms in which it is conventionally communicated. In some sense, Shariputra learned as much from Ashvajit's self-possessed and modest demeanor as from his words. Thus, the Dharma is always in some sense a message from the whole being of one person to the whole being of another. This is why there is no way to wisdom without faith and devotion, without a conscious orientation of body, speech, heart, and mind in the direction of what we have begun to apprehend to be the truth. The middle way. The principle of dependent origination takes its most familiar shape in what is called the discourse of the setting rolling of the wheel of the Dharma, the Buddha's first discourse, where dependent origination is elucidated in terms of the human condition and the spiritual path. This discourse outlines the whole of the Buddhist vision and the Buddhist way. This is how it opens.
Thus have I heard. At one time, the Exalted One was abiding in the deer park at Sarnath near Varanasi, where he addressed the group of 5 monks in the following way.
There are 2 extremes to be avoided by one who has gone forth. First, there is indulgence in sensual pleasure, which is brutish and unprofitable. Second, there is addiction to self-mortification, which is painful and unprofitable. The middle way, discovered by the Tathagata, the one who has gone beyond, transcends the extremes. It brings vision and knowledge, and is the path to peace, to insight, to enlightenment, to nirvana. The middle way is the Noble Eightfold Path. That is the path of right understanding, of right resolve, of right speech, of right action, of right livelihood, of right effort, of right mindfulness, and of right concentration.
To begin with, the Buddhist path is characterized as the middle way. This is not as simple as it sounds. It is not really about refusing a second helping of pudding or a third glass of wine. Indeed, the middle way between self-indulgence and self-mortification, for example, is not so much a principle as a certain attitude of mind. The classic illustration of the middle way is the story of Sona, who was so delicately nurtured that it was said that hairs grew on the soles of his feet.
After he was ordained, he went to dwell in the cool grove. As he practiced walking meditation, his feet blistered. The way he trod became gory as the floor of a slaughterhouse. The Blessed One went to his dwelling place and sat down on a seat prepared for him. And the Venerable Sona saluted him and sat down at one side. The Blessed One said,
when you were practicing just now, did it not occur to you, I am of the Blessed One's disciples who put effort into their practice, yet I have not attained the heart's release from attachment. What if I were to leave the holy life and go back to my family and use the wealth of my inheritance to perform good works instead?
That is so.
Tell me, Sona, were you not a fine performer on the lute when you were a layman?
I was, Lord.
So, when the strings of your lute were too taut, did your lute play well?
It did not, Lord.
But when those strings were slack, did your lute then play well?
It did not, Lord.
And when you tuned your strings appropriately, did your lute play well at last?
Yes, Lord.
Even so, Sona, should you exert an appropriate degree of effort.
The middle way is therefore of a completely different nature from the extremes which it negotiates. In tuning a stringed instrument, it is not enough to aim at some kind of average degree of tautness. Another faculty altogether must be brought in, a sense of musical pitch. The same goes for the middle way. It is not the way of moderation in all things. Buddhists should, for example, be quite immoderately happy. The middle way is to refrain from indulging one's craving, but to do it with the addition of something else, awareness and understanding. Nor is it enough just to understand the truth of things intellectually. One also needs to behave ethically and with kindness. Nor even is that enough. It is also necessary to train the mind through meditation. The middle way is to know when one is getting stuck in fixed attitudes, for which one will need friends and mentors. As in riding a bicycle, the balance achieved has a purpose far beyond the aim of not falling to one side or the other. The balance achieved on a bicycle is to enable one to travel swiftly to one's destination. The same goes for the middle way. Any extreme is an escape from ourselves, from being aware. We want to be certain, one way or another, rather than just to be aware. We want to escape from the insecurity and freedom of life in the raw, the challenge and beauty of being present to the whole of ourselves. We flinch from witnessing our own craving for the oblivion of pleasure or pain, our own hatred of what threatens our view of ourselves, our willful self-delusion. We would rather be able to follow rules and commandments than to be aware. In the end, the middle way is to be free from all views whatsoever, all categories, all conclusions, including Buddhist ones. This is not to say that one shouldn't hold Buddhist views, but in the end, one is not to be attached to them, not to get stuck to them. The Four Noble Truths. A more complete description of the Dharma is the Buddha's account of what he termed the Four Noble Truths.
Now this, monks, is the noble truth of suffering. To be born is suffering. To grow old is suffering. To fall sick is suffering. To die is suffering. Sorrow and loss, hurt, grief and despair are suffering. To have to put up with what one dislikes is suffering. Not to be able to have what one loves is suffering. In brief, all experience of mind and body affected by clinging is ingrained with suffering. This, monks, is the noble truth of the origin of suffering, which is craving. Craving produces rebirth and is accompanied by grasping and clinging. Craving is either for sensual distractions, for existence, or for non-existence. This, monks, is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering. It is attained through the ending of craving. This, monks, is the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. It is the noble eightfold path.
The Four Noble Truths are based on ancient medical procedures. First, one observes the symptoms. Secondly, one diagnoses the condition that gives rise to the problem. Thirdly, one assesses whether or not the problem can be cured. And fourthly, one identifies the correct treatment to bring that result about. The problem from the Buddha's point of view is that he is offering a cure for an ailment that few people are prepared to acknowledge. The Buddha's starting point is a very basic, straightforward one. He jettisoned all traditional religious concerns and went back to the source, not only of all spiritual activity, but of all human activity whatsoever, He was concerned not with ideas or speculation, not with interpretations of experience, but with experience itself. He begins with a specific characteristic of experience that has brought us out of the primeval swamp and is still the source of all our doings, all our thought, all our achievement. This is the universal itch that comes from dissatisfaction, existential unease, and psychological and physical discomfort and pain. The first noble truth, suffering. This is the first of the four noble truths. The truth of suffering, dukkha in Sanskrit, by which is meant the sense of imperfection in all experience, whether human or divine, whether painful or pleasurable. An unnecessarily mournful emphasis, it may be thought, and surprising in view of the extraordinary cheerfulness to be found in Buddhist populations. But one has only to ask oneself whether one should really want to live one's life over again, to realize that one's optimism is the triumph of hope over experience. And there is something more than just the presence of disappointment and pain in one's life. Dukkha haunts one's pleasures as well, because one cannot keep them. Absolutely nothing, down to the smallest atom, stands still. Not only that, if absolutely all things are impermanent, then strictly speaking, they are not things at all, but only processes. They are therefore without substance. There is nothing there to be impermanent, not even the most elementary particles. And though we may be able to understand that this is the case, that there is no substance or permanence to anything, including ourselves, we don't actually feel it, because this would undermine the whole emotional basis of our lives. The result of this, of wanting things to be different from the way they are, is a whole extra dimension of dissatisfaction which we are disinclined to look at, because we feel that there is nothing we can do about it. The Buddha would agree with us that we cannot change the way things are, but he does have a solution nevertheless. In drawing our attention to the full range of existential imperfection, the Buddha is not trying to wipe the smiles from our faces, quite the opposite. Nor is he offering future joys in some kind of a heaven to compensate for present pain. In fact, the development of wisdom here and now depends on the development of joy. The Buddha is preparing us for a freedom from aspects of suffering so deep that we can hardly even conceive of them. They are so endemic to the human condition, so ingrained in our everyday experience. For example, there is the subtle but deep unease felt by anyone who enjoys a satisfying, well-rewarded existence, while others lead cramped, painful, desperate lives. And then there is also the coming of death. One doesn't want to think about it because one rather imagines that it will spoil all the fun of life. However, if we can invite death to the party, if we can embrace it, then it will turn magically into a beautiful prince. The acceptance of the true nature of things, which is that they are inherently impermanent, insubstantial, and unsatisfactory, is our first step on a path to inconceivable freedom. The truth of suffering seems simple, but it isn't. Only an enlightened mind can fully understand it.
Hard is it to shoot many arrows one after another at a distance through a small keyhole and never miss. Even harder is it to penetrate into the truth that all is suffering.
But once we accept that imperfection is woven into the fabric of the world, we start to see our own suffering within a much larger perspective. We start to be more aware of all the suffering around us, and kindness arises in our hearts. As we relieve the pain of others, we find that our own is also immediately relieved. And if we start to take real care of ourselves, we find that others are able to draw upon our contentment and energy and confidence. The following verses are from a Mahayana Sutra in a Chinese translation of 428 AD.
The enlightened one, seeing humankind drowning in the great ocean of birth, death and sorrow, was roused to compassion. He saw that they abandoned themselves to the rank dissipation of the five lusts, and he was roused to compassion. He saw them chained to their money and possessions, not knowing how to slip free of them, and he was roused to compassion. He saw that they were afraid of pain, and yet repeatedly performed evil deeds that must bring them more pain, and he was roused to compassion. He saw those who had great wealth, unwilling to give any away, and he was roused to compassion. He saw all the people of the world ploughing, sowing, and reaping, getting and spending, dealing and making profits, and in the end gaining nothing but bitterness, and he was roused to compassion.
The second noble truth. The origin of suffering is craving. The Buddha saw that dukkha, suffering, was inescapable. He was also able to see why it was so, which brings us to the second of the four noble truths, the truth of the origin of suffering. He saw that it was not impermanence itself that really threatened people. After all, the sorrows of life are impermanent as well as the joys. No, what actually ties people to the endless experience of unhappiness and loss, called samsara, the round of suffering, is this very hanging on to something, this illusory sense that there is something solid and unchanging to hang on to. Suffering is inescapable because we try to escape from it in an impulse of craving. What brings us back again and again into the world of suffering is our craving. And our response to suffering is more craving, because we will not accept the essential connection between the two. He saw that this impulse of craving, together with the inability to connect craving and suffering, was a function of living from the mistaken notion of a separate essence, an unchanging core of ourselves, a soul. Building our lives around this illusion of our own inherently separate existence, we are building our own prison of ignorance, craving, and suffering. The Buddha was very careful, however, not to suggest that we don't exist, or even that we lack a self. His concern was that our emotionally based assumptions about the self shouldn't undermine our progress towards the truth. There is basically no point in attempting to understand reality if, at the same time, our emotions are engaged in craving what is unreal. Our ignorance and our craving are meshed together in a process that we call the self, from which neither can be unraveled on its own. The Buddha is not trying to deny our experience of ourselves or our identity, but he is pointing out that this identity changes, so it isn't fixed. In fact, if one is going to identify oneself with anything, it should be with one's own body, which has an obvious continuity to it and an equally obvious conclusion. To identify oneself with the mind is ridiculous because it changes from moment to moment. As for identifying with the soul, this is much more dangerous because it projects our separation from the rest of life into eternity. Hanging on to the self is like holding on to a jar of water when we can have a river. The Buddha is saying not, I think, therefore I am, but there is thinking and no thinker to be found. From the Buddhist perspective, what we feel to be the self is just the way we disengage from reality and limit our experience. The way we get caught up in a hopeless situation of building up our separate, narrow, rickety worlds of petty ambitions and hidden fears, of little rages and muffled anxieties, of pathetic desires and brief joys. This sad and sorry procession is what we call I, me, myself. The wheel of life, a mirror of craving and ignorance. A clear image of this process called the self is the wheel of life depicted on the walls of Tibetan Buddhist temples. This wheel is the vision of one of the Buddha's foremost disciples, called Moggallana, who was known above all for his supernormal powers. He could enter into the minds of others so deeply that he actually saw the realms they inhabited. In fact, his intuitive understanding of others' problems put him in such demand as a teacher that the Buddha arranged to have the pith of Moggallana's teaching depicted visually and painted at the entrance to every monastery. The image that was put together is a sort of circular mirror reflecting the cyclic pattern of our lives back to us. It is held up by the terrifying figure of Yama, the Lord of Death, though like all the fierce images in Tibetan art, his function is an essentially compassionate one. He looks terrifying because that is the way we see death, as terrifying. When the fear of death is overcome by wisdom and compassion, then the monster is transformed back into its benign aspect. As always, what we see and experience is, in the end, our own mind.